From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump travels to South Dakota today to celebrate the 4th of July with fireworks at Mount Rushmore. There will be no requirements to wear a mask or to social distance.
Just yesterday, the president bowed to pressure and urged people to wear masks to try to stem the rising number of coronavirus cases in most states. Let's bring in Tolu Olorunipa, who is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Tolu, yesterday President Trump claimed the coronavirus is under control. He said the economy is roaring back. Let's listen.
The number of unemployed Americans re-entering the labor force rose by 43%. And fewer workers are dropping out of the labor force than before. And the crisis is being handled.
The facts do not back up what he said there, though. I wonder how politically dangerous Trump's optimism is on the pandemic and on the economy, and if the economy especially continues to deteriorate.
Yes, the president was touting numbers from much earlier last month at a time when coronavirus cases were not spiking the way they are now. And we have started to see a number of states reimpose shutdown orders, close restaurants, close bars, and that could obviously impact future numbers. It can impact the job numbers in the month ahead, and also consumer confidence and business confidence if we're at record high cases as we have been over the past week, and with the virus continuing to spread despite the president's assertions that the virus is going away. It's gonna have a potential impact on the economy that the president has been touting. So there is risk in him saying that everything is going great and being so optimistic when the numbers just don't bear that out.
And Tolu, who he is trying to celebrate this weekend as well. He's in South Dakota at Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills. We've been talking a lot about that this week. Not everyone is happy about it. Where does the president find himself politically going into this holiday?
Well, he continues to be an outlier on things like masks and on social distancing. Even as Republican senators are telling people to wear masks, the president has not worn a mask. He's started to come around to the idea of saying that masks are not a bad idea. He has also continued to hold these massive rallies. We're not seeing other politicians or really anyone else in the country holding mass gatherings. But the president held a rally in Oklahoma last month. He held another one in Arizona. And now he's going to have thousands of people at Mount Rushmore, not social distancing, no requirement to wear a mask. The president is really pushing these practices that are seen as risky by public health experts and that are recommended that Americans avoid, and the president is egging on Americans to do just those things. So he's finding himself increasingly isolated on those public health measures as he flouts the advice of even his own administration's public health experts.
I want to ask you about Sinclair Broadcasting's Eric Bolling, who gave Trump another chance to describe what the president's second term is all about. This after Trump was criticized for not being able to answer that question in a Fox News interview last week. Let's listen now to some of the president's answer. This again is with Sinclair Broadcasting.
It's very simple. We're going to make America great again. We are doing things that nobody could have done. We've rebuilt the military. We have a ways to go. We've done things for the vets like nobody's ever seen. We can do even more. We did choice, as you know. We did accountability. What we've done, nobody's been able to do.
Tolu, the president is looking back when he was given a chance to look forward. Why do you think he's struggling with the question?
Yeah, that's the second time that he struggled to answer that question. And in part, he wants to spend a lot more of his time reminiscing on his first 3 years in office, specifically the first 3 years before the pandemic hit. And he wants to say that the economy was great and that he did all of these various things to add to his record and essentially say that he made America great again. But the fact that he is saying that his second term agenda is to make America great again, it's a sign that things have not gone according to plan in the first term. It's a sign that there are a lot of things that have not been accomplished, and there are a lot of things that need to still be accomplished. And I think he's reluctant to acknowledge the fact that he hasn't accomplished everything he set out to accomplish, that the economy is actually in worse shape than it was when he took office. There are millions of more unemployed people, and that there's a lot of work to do, and a lot of the backsliding has happened under his watch. And I think he's reluctant to say that. He would rather spend time sort of reminiscing about his record in the first 3 years and really touting his record and saying that he's done a great job and done what no other president could do. And that makes it harder once you're so defensive like that to project forward and to give a vision for the next 4 years when you're really mired in the last 3 years and focusing on what you've already done.
Well, here's Joe Biden's thoughts about Donald Trump's record. Let's listen.
Donald Trump just had given up. He's not even trying to secure the public health anymore. He'd rather go back to the campaign rallies. He's not interested in uniting us in this fight of a common threat we face. And he's decided he's more has more to gain by dividing this country for his own political purposes.
Tolu, how is Joe Biden doing? We know he's leading in most of the polls, but is he doing well because people are responding to him or because they're responding to his opponent, President Trump?
Well, Joe Biden has kept a pretty low profile, and it seems at this point that that strategy is working. He's letting Trump really punch himself out to an extent because Trump's numbers are plummeting at a time when Joe Biden isn't doing a lot of public appearances. He's not spending a lot of time taking up the national spotlight. He's really letting President Trump do that on his own and allowing the public to assess President Trump for themselves. And that alone is allowing Joe Biden's numbers to go up and President Trump's numbers to go down. Now, the Trump campaign says that once Biden gets on the debate stage, he won't be able to hide anymore. But at this point, it seems like his strategy is working.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to leave it there. Tolu Olorunipa, the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Nice to speak with you once again, Tolu. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to Texas, where cases of COVID-19 have swelled 34% over the last week, with 7,000 people hospitalized heading into the 4th of July weekend. In a sudden change of policy last night, Governor Greg Abbott is now mandating masks in most public spaces, including restaurants, which are still allowed to operate at 50% capacity. But with all the rule changes and risk, some restaurant owners say it's just not worth it. Bill Loveday is one of them. He owns Beccaro Kitchen and Wine Bar in Houston. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Peter.
You and so many other business owners have been on a wild ride these last few months. How are you doing, first of all?
Well, right now we're shut down, so we could be doing better. It's been very, very tough. We, on March 16th, we were given the mandate to shut down inside operations, and we went to takeaway and home delivery only. Now, we're an operation that's kind of small, bistro wine bar, semi-formal, carpeting, white tablecloth, real crystal. We maybe did 3 or 4 takeaway orders a week, and so we had to quickly pivot and create a new sense of operations. And then on May 1st, the governor allowed restaurants to open for inside dining at 25% capacity. We chose not to. We thought it was too early. Then on May 22nd, he increased the allowance to 50%. We still thought it was too early for the health and wellness of our employees. And the fact that we're losing money anyway, so we thought the best thing, the ethical decision, was to shut down.
That is a big decision, though, to decide just to close up operations. What's the financial status of your business? I know you got a PPP loan, a Paycheck Protection Loan. Has that helped you out?
Well, okay, so when we first went to takeaway, we went down to probably about 30% of our normal revenues. And we were keeping our head above water. You know, quite frankly, we were just keeping people employed. And, we wanted, like my chef, he's the sole earner for his family. We furloughed a couple of people, but in general, we, kept a tight staff, including my kids and myself. And we were doing takeaway 7 days a week. Now, when the governor then allowed restaurants to open for inside dining and we chose not to, we saw a big decline in our takeaway numbers, but we did have the PPP loan. And as of this week, we've spent the last of that loan.
The Restaurant Association of Texas says it thinks up to 30% of restaurants in the state will close for good. Do you think you might be among them?
Probably. At this stage, I'm very pessimistic. Quite frankly, I think the best course of action for us would have been that everyone, the entire state required all restaurants to stay on takeaway only for another month, like we did, staying closed, and then nip this spread or potential surge in the bud and then start to slowly open. We felt that with the help of the PPP loan, we could probably weather the storm. Now, when we closed down 2 weeks ago or on the 22nd, There were 5,000 new cases a day in Texas. Now we're at 8,000 every day. I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel right now. And that's just the pessimism. And this coming Monday was our date to really decide whether we were going to reopen or not. I don't see how we could do it right now.
Bill Loveday is owner of the Beccaro Kitchen and Wine Bar in Houston. Not open right now as cases of COVID-19 surge across Texas. Bill, thank you and best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter.
This 4th of July weekend, the United States is confronting unprecedented challenges. A pandemic is raging. A reckoning on racism is boiling over. To mark this moment, our producers asked people across the country what it means to be an American in 2020 and what it means to be free. This is what they found.
Hi, my name is Bao Nguyen. I am living in Los Angeles, California. I'm 36 and I'm a filmmaker. So this year, July 4th, it makes me think about what America is and what America can become and what America's promise is. My parents were Vietnamese war refugees who spent 2 weeks out at sea leaving Vietnam because they felt like they had no future in their former homeland. And I often think about them and their journey when I think about my own American journey in many ways, because without their journey, I wouldn't be here. For me, America is so many things. It's not just a country. It's really this ever-evolving story. We continually help create what its identity is. And I think for the most part, freedom is a social contract. It's not something that's given, it's something that's earned in many ways. Even in a place like America where people assume that it's given, we've earned our freedom through sacrifice, through bloodshed, through labor and toil of people who have been marginalized, underrepresented. All these communities today that are standing up, they have fought for this freedom, and we continue to fight for this freedom, and I don't think we should take it for granted.
My name is Lucy Hutchins. I live in Downey, Maine. I'm a mother, a grandmother of three, a wife, and a senior software engineer. I was born and raised in Cameroon in West Africa, came to the U.S. in 97, and became U.S. citizen in 2008. As an American, I should feel safe and protected within the American soil from any attack, military, terrorism, or biological. In a country where freedom is the norm, I should not fear to voice my opinion. My skin color, my religion, or my sex orientation should not predict what I can do, what I can achieve, or who I can become. Living in America today is both shameful and hopeful. It is shameful to know that in a country with the biggest defense budget in the world, in a country with the best educational and research institutions, the mortality rate for COVID-19 is higher than it is in countries like South Korea. It is a shame that in a country where freedom is the norm, the likelihood of being mistreated, denied opportunities, or even killed just because you are different is still high. Black Lives Matter is a wake-up call. I see the silent majority joining hands with the movement to demand change. I see hope.
Bonjour, Ani, Eskude, Nini, Nindish, Nakash, Ishkagu, Nindunjaba, Amik, Nadudim. Hello, everyone. My name is Anthony Temez Posel. I'm West Pacific First Nations Cree, Sichangu, Lakota, and Black. I'm located in the city of Chicago, and I'm 21 years old. I'm the vice chair of the Center for Native Americans Youth Advisory Board, as well as work for the 33rd Ward Alderman, Rosana Rodriguez, in the city of Chicago. So freedom to me is something that communities of color and indigenous communities, you know, we're always working towards freedom, but we have, you know, we've never gained it yet, right? But I think indigenous communities more relies on tribal sovereignty and the United States, you know, respecting that. To be an American, I don't think it really means anything to me because I'm part of these sovereign nations and I'm black, right? So that part of me was forcefully bought over here. And so I wouldn't say that I necessarily celebrate the 4th of July. I have the day off, so I'm definitely going to use it as a time to rest and a time to sit back and recognize my role for, you know, both of my communities, my black community and my native community.
So my name is John Rogers. I'm 60, and I'm a coal miner. I used to be a coal miner, at least. I still work for the coal industry. And I'm actually speaking to you from my home here on the farm in Western Kentucky. The coronavirus has been very problematic, obviously. And people's nerves are on edge. And there was a very terrible thing that happened to a man by the police who we trust. And it was terrible. We've got to come together as a nation. And we can work through this. Our freedoms were given us by generations before us. And it's our responsibility to protect those freedoms and hand it down to our children and our grandchildren. And we can do that without fighting amongst ourselves, if you will. That's my opinion. You know, I lost both my parents last year. Father served in the military, and he told me about freedoms. It's very important for us that have never served to understand what a gift we've been given. We just need to guard the freedoms that we have, because freedom is the right to be able to live your life like you want to. And we as parents need to make sure our children understand that.
And how will history judge all the voices that make up this moment in America? Let's bring in Clay Jenkinson. He's a historian and an expert on Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, who lives in Bismarck, North Dakota. He joins us on a Skype line. Clay, welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And when you hear those voices, people from all walks of life across this beautiful and often troubled country, you think what?
You know, listening to them, it's both extremely hopeful and heartbreaking at the same time. Hopeful because they're optimists. They believe in the idea of America. And I've noticed that new Americans or recent Americans, immigrants, often have a much greater commitment to the ideals of America than the people who have been living here all of their lives, who in some ways take it for granted. So that's the hopeful, wonderful part of it. But it's heartbreaking too, because so many of the Americans who have been here for generations are disillusioned, jaded, cynical, feeling very angry and unsettled. And I think this is one of the most important July 4ths of my lifetime. I'm 65 years old. We're at an inflection point, and we need to really take this one seriously.
That reminds me of something that you've written, which is that in 2020, it is the year that we couldn't breathe, and that we sounds collective. Sounds like you're saying everyone can't breathe.
Yes, I wrote that piece in governing.com, and it's called The Year We Couldn't Breathe. And of course, it begins with George Floyd, 8 minutes and 46 seconds. But then I reflected that everyone who's been on a ventilator, and there have been tens of thousands, has also said, I can't breathe. And I think it's worse than that. I think as a civilization, as a nation, we're having a hard time breathing. We're hunched over. We're frightened. We're worried about what's about to come. The discourse is so poisonous in some respects that we just can't step back, take a deep breath, and enjoy the blessings of American liberty. And so I think we need to learn to breathe again, each of us individually and as friends and as couples and as culture. But we also, I think, need to remember that Jefferson, even though, you know, he's a highly imperfect human being, a slaveholder, among other things, he launched that sentence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." And what I've been reflecting on this week is that if that didn't mean everything, then it meant nothing. You know, in other words, if it means white males of a certain property base, then it's a meaningless statement. If you say all human beings are created equal, at some point you're going to have to step up to that ideal. And if you don't, you're just humbug.
Hmm. I'm glad you brought up Jefferson, because you also embody Thomas Jefferson as an impersonator of him. It's another one of the reasons why you're somewhat famous around the country. Tell me more about, you know, what you're thinking about Jefferson the man during all of this. As you say, he was a slave owner. He also fathered children with women he enslaved.
Well, one woman at least, Sally Hemings. I'm so disappointed in Jefferson. You know, when I started doing this a couple of decades ago, he was riding high, and he was almost regarded as an accidental slaveholder. And that was foolish. Now we know it's just the opposite end of the spectrum. That puts him into a very difficult position. He's a hypocrite and maybe a contemptible hypocrite, and there are people that just can't take him seriously anymore, because how could you say that? All human beings are created equal, and then buy and sell them and somehow learn to live with that whopping contradiction. So this is a period in which Jefferson is really on the ropes, and I take it very personally because I love him. But I think that that sentence is much, much, much greater than Thomas Jefferson, and we need his principles, even if we're going to give him a D minus or worse in his personal behavior. So we would, the biggest mistake we could make would be to jettison Jefferson and the Jeffersonian just because we've now realized that he was a highly imperfect man.
Clay Jenkinson, historian and writer. His latest book is Bring Out Your Dead, The History and Literature of Epidemics, which I bring up because, Clay, you cover it all, don't you?
I have a very wide range. I do a number of characters, but Jefferson is very central, and we need him. He is the founding father, warts and all.
Clay Jenkinson, thank you so much.
Happy 4th of July, everyone.
California has temporarily housed more than 10,000 people without homes in hotel rooms. It's happening through a statewide project called Roomkey. The aim is to find shelter for seniors and people with serious health conditions during the pandemic. But now the question on everyone's mind is, what happens next? Molly Solomon of member station KQED reports.
There are two beds in Alan Tolbert's hotel room. One is for him, and the other is for his pit bull terrier, Coco.
It's way better than the shelter system. I get to keep my dog. You get 3 square meals a day, as much as you want.
He says what he's most grateful for is the privacy. He tells me it's the first time in more than 2 years that he's had a room to call his own.
There's a big difference. I feel safer. I can rest better. I can sleep better.
The 48-year-old from San Francisco is the kind of person Project Roomkey was designed to help. He's diagnosed with congestive heart failure, which puts him in a high-risk category if he were to contract COVID-19. Governor Gavin Newsom introduced the effort in the early days of the pandemic.
Project Roomkey would identify 15,000 hotel rooms throughout the state of California.
Alan Tolbert is one of more than 14,000 homeless people who have temporarily moved into hotel rooms. And now the governor wants to turn that into a permanent solution by buying hotels across the state and transforming them into housing.
So uniquely, the crisis has created this tool of the hotel and motel strategy that can really help formerly homeless people come inside.
That's Tamika Moss, founder of the advocacy group All Home. Normally, it would take an eternity to get this many people housed. But the pandemic has forced the state to act quickly, and she wants to see that sense of urgency continue.
Really elevating the political will in this moment to stay focused on ending homelessness in California.
But it's not going to be easy or cheap. For now, FEMA is covering the bulk of the hotel costs, and the new state budget includes $600 million to help counties permanently purchase the hotels. But that doesn't take into account the cost of running the program, providing medical care, delivering food, staffing social workers. In Alameda County, the work is being led by Carrie Abbott, director of the Office of Homeless Care and Coordination. She says the future of Project Roomkey rests on the amount of funding they can secure.
It's going to be budget dependent, but we were hoping to be able to use our funds to keep people in place for at least several more months.
Abbott says hotels aren't the only option. They're trying anything and everything to house people beyond the pandemic. Recently, the Board of Supervisors approved $23 million to purchase three properties, including a former dorm for international students in Oakland. Abbott says there's another goal, quickly moving 400 people into existing affordable apartments.
Trying to really get people into housing now, because obviously that's an even better situation than Project Room Key.
For Alan Tolbert, moving into his hotel room has been transformative. His stress levels have gone down, and he's even put on some weight from the steady supply of hotel meals. Tolbert says he can't imagine returning to a large congregate shelter.
They're not going to put us on the street because that defeats the purpose. Most people can't afford an apartment, so they're gonna have to do something, right?
An urgent question from Tolbert and the other 14,000 people who for now are living in hotel rooms. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Solomon.
COVID-19 has caused many summer traditions to be put on hold, including Frontier Days in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which was canceled for the first time in 124 years. Ever since 1897, Cheyenne has held what's been called the world's largest outdoor rodeo and Western celebration. And in 1908, it was the site of a stunning upset when three cowboys from Hawaii tried to unseat the local champions and won. What most watching at that time didn't know was that these Hawaiians came from a ranching tradition that was decades older than anything in Texas, Wyoming, or Colorado. Authors David Woolman and Julian Smith tell this story in their book, Aloha Rodeo. I spoke with them in May 2019. So maybe the most interesting thing that we learn in this book is how cattle first come to the Hawaiian Islands and become an invasive species. David, why don't you pick it up? Start there. How did those cows get on the island?
Sure. Well, this was at the very end of the 18th century. Captain George Vancouver is sailing to the islands, and part of the British Empire's strategy worldwide was to bring gifts to these faraway lands that they were visiting, but also what they really perceived as kind of useful gifts. And one of the gifts was some longhorn cattle. The king puts a taboo on killing any of the cattle, and so they reproduce wildly and very quickly, and within a matter of like 2 decades, there are thousands and thousands of feral cattle running all over the island of Hawaii.
And so they become almost a little too useful and so numerous that they need to be controlled. So that is going to lead to the rise of these Hawaiian cowboys, or as you described them, paniolos. What was their job like?
Their job was basically to find the cattle, first of all, in the jungles where they were hiding out. And they would rope these cows and bulls and take them down the mountainside, often across these barren, dry lava fields down onto the beach. And then they had to get them onto the boats that were waiting offshore because there weren't really any big docks where the boats could pull up.
These cowboys drove the cows into the surf, right?
Yep, they did. They used specially trained horses. They drove the cows straight into the ocean. They weren't always so cooperative. And of course, it being Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, every so often, a shark would cruise by and say, there's lunch, and take out a cow or two.
You did not see that in Wyoming at the time, I'm sure of that. But you did focus on one of these cowboys in particular. His name was Ikua Purdy, and he was legendary. He was like the best around. What can you tell us about him?
Ikua Purdy is a third generation cowboy in the islands. And so, you know, before he's a teenager, I mean, this guy, he's riding horses all of the time. Ranching and cattle is just part of life there. And Ikua very quickly demonstrates a kind of virtuosity when it comes to riding and roping. That sort of leads to this idea after the turn of the 20th century that maybe this guy should be sent off to Wyoming to compete with some of the cowboys on the mainland.
Okay, so let's put the pause button on Ikua Purdy for a second. We're going to get back to him and what he does in Wyoming eventually, but let's talk about Cheyenne, Wyoming, which in its own right had become something of a cattle mecca. And at one point, you write, it was one of the wealthiest cities of its size in the world.
Yeah, the story of Cheyenne is really incredible. It started out as, you know, one of the many dusty outposts along the Transcontinental Railroad. But when the great age of the cattle drive started in the 1860s, 1870s, they had all these cattle down in Texas. but they needed to fatten them up. And what Cheyenne had at that time was it was close to these huge grasslands, and they were open for the taking. And it was also connected by rail with markets back east. So it kind of had this 1-2 combination, and it had the amazing cowboys who lived there. So that combination led to this incredible stratospheric boom time in Cheyenne history. And then when the age of the cattle drives started to end, when the Wild West was being fenced off by homesteaders and barbed wire, its crash was just as fast.
Mm. And because of that, the city needed something. It was kind of desperate to get its name back on the map. And that's where the Frontier Days comes in, right?
Right. The city fathers, they saw how quickly Cheyenne had risen and crashed. And they looked around and they said, we need something else or else this town may dry up and vanish. So they looked at other cities that had had these rodeos that were just starting to spread. Denver had some festivals, other cities in Wyoming. There's a great quote where one of the city fathers said, we don't raise anything in Cheyenne except hell, because all these other cities had these agricultural festivals.
Yeah, there was like the potato day and the pickle day.
And they really wanted to take advantage of that hard edge.
Right. It was a really interesting time in American history. It was kind of the twilight of the Wild West, and they were conscious of that. They saw this incredible time in American history that they were so proud of and still are. But they saw it starting to fade. And so they consciously decided to preserve this heritage. And one of the ways of doing that was through rodeos. It was as much a celebration of Western culture and history as it was a demonstration of the incredible talent of these cowboys.
Well, and speaking of a PR move, somebody there had this idea that they should get the Hawaiians to come to Wyoming to make this absolutely monumental journey from the Hawaiian Islands to the Mountain West. Tell us how that happened and how they decided that Ikua Purdy should come and rope steer.
What happened is the year before the 1908 Cheyenne Frontier Days, in 1907, a Hawaiian cowboy named Eben Lowe traveled to the States and to the mainland and went to watch Cheyenne Frontier Days. And Eben is sitting in the stands watching the local talent compete. And he's thinking, essentially, my cousins could beat these guys. So Eben makes this suggestion, and he actually first invites some of the guys from Wyoming to come to Honolulu in December of 1907. And there's a great moment there because one guy goes down to compete. He leaves a blizzard in Wyoming in December, gets to Honolulu. By the way, he's looking around at rainbows. And
he's like, I'm never leaving this place.
And he never left. And he never left. So anyway, so that was how we see the seed being planted for the cowboys to go from the islands to Cheyenne in 1908.
When the Hawaiians get to Cheyenne, how are they received? Because they must have seemed like such outsiders and even foreigners.
Right. At that point, a lot of people weren't even aware that the Hawaiian Islands had been annexed by the United States roughly 10 years before. So these guys show up. They look obviously very different. Their equipment is somewhat similar, but also a little different than the local cowboys. They had leis around their cowboy hats. And so they show up in Cheyenne where, you know, in Wyoming at the time, the attitude was there's no better cowboys than Wyoming cowboys. They had won every competition almost in Frontier Days over the past 10 years that had been held. So when these guys show up, it's a mix of curiosity and patronizing almost a little bit. They said, oh, yeah, we're glad that they came, but there's no way they can win.
And it wasn't true. The Wyomingites were not the best cowboys. These guys from Hawaii won.
There's this wonderful evolution in the newspaper record covering Frontier Days competition during that summer, because at first, the news of the Hawaiians coming to town, you know, that was something to be celebrated and further affirmation that Frontier Days was the preeminent rodeo in the world. Then on day one, after the Hawaiians demonstrate their prowess, you see this shift in the sort of sports writing coverage that is like, okay, well, it's great that we welcomed them here, but now Wyoming guys, like, let's send them packing.
Right.
And, you know, we need to remind them sort of who's best, who's boss. And, of course, that's not how it transpired.
On the third day, the day of the championship, they take the prize. They take the trophy home, essentially. And then they go back to Hawaii. They're heroes at home. What did Ikua Purdy's victory mean for Hawaiians and the identity of people on the islands, which, as you say, not long before had been annexed by the United States?
Hawaii was going through an identity crisis at the time. Basically, they had been absorbed into this huge, far-flung empire, and they were wondering how they fit into the political sphere of the world. And there's a great quote in one of the papers after these guys get back home, which, by the way, they were received with these huge parties. Every time they stepped off the boat, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people singing. They composed songs in their honor. They composed hula in their honor. There's a great quote from one of the papers that says, "We've shown the United States Hawaii is more than a hula platform in the far Pacific." And that kind of sums up what it meant for these people culturally. They had crossed an ocean and they had beaten the Americans at their own game, even though they were now part of the United States.
Well, it's a great book, Aloha Rodeo, Julian Smith and David Woolman. Thanks very much for writing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interview with David and Julian aired in May 2019. Public health officials across the United States are telling Americans to stay home this holiday weekend, giving many of us an opportunity to fire up the grill and have a picnic in the backyard. Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is the perfect person to bring to the party. But we are social distancing, so we're going to have to do it on the radio instead. Kathy, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Hi, Peter.
So we're going to talk about 4th of July side dishes today. Where do you want to start?
Well, I really wanted to take a new look at some old favorites. So I was thinking about coleslaw. People seem to be on both sides of the fence. They either love it or hate it.
I
like it a lot. I do too, but I wanted to rethink of it. And then I thought about a wedge salad, you know, that classic big hunk of iceberg lettuce with like blue cheese or whatever on it. Mm-hmm. So this is what I came up with. This dish, I say, is like a hybrid of coleslaw and wedge. I took a cabbage, I cut it into wedges, I brushed it with olive oil, and then I grilled it over a hot heat, whether it's charcoal, gas, wood, until it's almost blackened and very softened.
Wait a minute, Kathy. You're saying you're making coleslaw on the barbecue.
I am. I'm saying you're going to hey, you know what? If ever there were time to rethink something, we are in
it. I love it.
And this,
I love it. Tell
this
me more.
So you grill the cabbage wedges. They get really soft, a little bit blackened on the outside. Then you put it on a serving plate, and you make a yogurt and scallion and caper dressing. And then you top it with grated raw carrots. So there's a little bit of the old coleslaw. It's a brand new texture and taste. And I have to say, I think it might be my favorite recipe that I've developed in a long time. I highly recommend it. Super easy. You can grill the cabbage ahead of time, make the dressing ahead of time. So it's great for a backyard picnic. It's great for any summer meal.
Hmm. I love your job. You're just like, well, what am I going to do now? I'm going to come up with a way to grill a cabbage.
There you go.
I know you have. Yep. I know you have some fresh ideas for a macaroni salad. How are you going to spice that one up?
Actually, that is something I am not a fan of. And I know we'll hear from people who are like, what? I don't like the idea of mayonnaise and pasta cold. Anyway, we can talk about that another time. I wanted to take a new look at macaroni and cheese, which I don't think of as a summer dish. It tends to be kind of a comfort food and heavy. But I thought, how can we do sort of mac and cheese meets summer? And I got the idea. I went in my garden, but you can go to a farmer's market or anywhere and take some greens, raw kale or spinach, collard greens, arugula, Swiss chard. Throw it in a blender with some garlic and parsley and basil, a green chili pepper and olive oil, and you get this vibrant green puree. And then I made a really good macaroni and cheese and swirled this summery greens into it. And wow, it was like, hello, summer, meat mac and cheese.
Good.
It really worked. Yeah.
Good, good. Here's another thing that screams summer, watermelon. What do you want to do with that?
So watermelon is just so refreshing. I mean, there's just nothing like it on a hot summer day. And watermelon and feta cheese you often see in salads together. But I thought, okay, what about taking it to the next level? So stick with me because it sounds strange. This is a watermelon, roasted cherry tomatoes, feta, mint, and green olive salad. And essentially, you take sweet, juicy watermelon balls, you scoop them out with that melon scooper, salty olives, umami-rich roasted cherry tomatoes, and then salty, creamy feta with the brightness of fresh mint. This is a super refreshing and incredibly colorful salad.
Kathy, you had me until olives. I'll be honest, I do not like olives. Should I just leave them out or should I substitute something?
I think you should leave them out. Absolutely. You should leave them out and maybe up the feta or some more cherry tomatoes. What I found is that the olives added a meatiness to the salad, whether they're green or black. And of course, that touch of salt. And salt and watermelon surprisingly go really well together.
You know, we're kind of on a roll here because I'm growing watermelons and cabbage in my garden today. So I think they're not ready yet. They're not ready yet, but, you know, a few weeks more. Listen, Kathy, this has been fun, but this is kind of a weird 4th of July. There's this pandemic going on. We're talking a lot about race relations in this country, which are not good. What have you been reflecting on this 4th of July?
Boy, I've been reflecting on a lot, but I guess the question of freedom, what does it mean? What does it mean to you? It means something different to everyone. And how do we bring everybody into this conversation and listen? I've been doing a lot of listening and a lot of reading and a lot of reflecting. And of course, the other important thing that's going on right now is the pandemic. So staying home, these recipes only serve 4 people. We're not talking about inviting a crowd into your backyard this weekend. Keep it safe. Keep your mask on. And keep listening to everyone and get a conversation going that opens things up.
You know, you make a good point. We want to bring everybody together. It's easy to do that around a table. But right now, it is not easy to do that. So we are in complicated times. But thank you for taking a moment to talk about food with us, Kathy.
Thank you, Peter. Be well.
You too. We'll have all of our recipes at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
The pandemic is raging across the country. We'll speak with Dr. Tom Frieden, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control, about what to watch for next as the coronavirus threatens lives and livelihoods across America. That's next time on Here and Now.